Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me this week, once again, it's the barrister from Bourbon Town, Brian. How goes it, Brian?
Hey, Scott. Good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We're going to claim that we took off last week due to the 4th of July holiday, which is really a nice way of saying that I couldn't get my shit together here. We were supposed to. I don't know. I just couldn't get myself up to do it. I don't know why. Had nothing to do with the show. It was just more, I was tired. So as a result, we will be covering not one, but two, count them, two episodes of Legion tonight. And who the heck knows what else we might be talking about. But then again, with two episodes of Legion, that should be more than enough, quite frankly. Since we are doing double duty tonight. Duty. And as you heard from our opening, unfortunately, while Dan is not on the podcast, it means he's also not doing post-production, so you're still hearing me play music over the microphone, and we won't have the lovely little in-between things that we like to pop into our usual Legion podcast. So you guys will have to forgive the extreme no-frills, lemonade stand-like nature of our podcast lately. But with that all said, let's get right to last week's episode, which was otherwise known as Chapter 21. Now, as stated in our inaugural Legion podcast a couple weeks ago, not going to be doing a scene-by-scene recap, just a brief nutshell here up front, then we can just dive in whenever, wherever we see fit. So let's give that a shot here. Now, the story went something like this. Realizing that Switch isn't able to bring him along for the ride on any of these time-traveling trips, David needs someone to help build a tank or tool or something that will amplify her powers. So Lenny and what I am now calling the Davidians lay a little trap that nabs Carrie Loudermilk, scientist and clown extraordinaire. Along the way, David and Sid also have a conversation that really clarifies both the delusions and denial that starting to fit David like a form-fitting orange tunic. Okay, I think that's my synopsis. So, Brian, I've talked enough. The floor is yours. Where do you want to go first with this episode?
I liked this episode. It was short for Legion. It moved the story along. I think the main three points that it hit for me that I found enjoyable was we finally had David and Sid have a conversation. So if you want to start there, yeah. I think the black cloud that's hung over the show is the, you know, sexual assault of Sid by David, and we get some dialogue on that I found to be really well written, with both characters coming at it from what I thought were believable points of view, ending with David being, I guess you see his sort of wounded child nature at the end. Right. But I thought it was really good. I was left from that scene. I felt more sympathetic for David than I thought I would. I wasn't convinced by him, but it just seemed like two wounded people. But at the end, he could not accept there was no way to undo what he did. And Sid, you know, I thought particularly the powerful moment for me was where Sid confronted him that even if he time traveled to erase all that, that it would still be just another trick where he would be trying to keep from her what he did and, right, you know, sort of pegged down to the core of it. And so I thought that was the question after the end of season two, that we wondered where can that lead? And I think we got, you know, sort of a nice resolution, at least, of them talking about it to see how they each felt and where the show might go.
Right. Yeah, I would also agree that probably outside of, you know, driving the overall plot forward with the machinations in this episode with Loudermilk, whatever, the thing of most significance was the conversation between Sid and David. So totally agree there. And what? And yeah, when she points that out to him, because that's just another version of the whole drugging her or making someone forget something that had happened. It's, you know, it's a time travel version of a roofie, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
The fact that when we've seen this season and this episode and the previous one and a little bit in the next one, but really this episode, David still gives into his own delusions, and he's in a strong sense of denial. He's not able to see himself that way. Everything with David and a lot of these characters is about perceptions, but he's not able to perceive himself the way he really is, which is actually something that is said, is quoted later on in the episode when he's with Carrie Loudermilk. I don't know if I wrote down the exact quote. I should have. But it was something along the lines of the way David sees himself is not the way he appears to everyone else. It's definitely more articulate than that, but something along those lines. And it applies here. The fact that he genuinely sees himself at this point as a victim, as she reiterates later on when she's talking with Farouk, of all people, which is in of itself a strange situation happening in the series right now. It's really got to give them credit, give Holly credit, and I actually want to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. It's really speaking to our times right now. It's a very Me Too era kind of a thing where the person, what do you call the person? Well, in this case, it literally is like a rapist, but in other things, it's the harasser or the antagonizer or whatever, often will see themselves as the victim, you know, because of the accusations or whatever, or this shouldn't be as bad as you make it out to be, or this can be easily fixed or resolved. They always will view themselves that way. And that's kind of what David has done here. So I am, it's weird to say happy, but I appreciated that they tackled it now, that we didn't have to wait several episodes for it even to be mentioned. Like, 'cause that's kind of the thing. I mean, even though it seems like he's going back, he wants to go back in time much further, like even like pre Farouk entering him as a baby, that whole kind of situation. This seems to be mostly about him wanting to fix this. And the way he views, David has been saying this entire season, he keeps talking about how he deserves to be loved. And he keeps falling back on that. And I think Sid says something along the lines like, I'm not sure that he really knows what love is. Because if he views what he did as something that can just be easily smoothed over, or that he even did it, quote unquote, out of love, perhaps, then maybe he doesn't have an understanding of that. And if you look at how his life is up until this point, you know, there may be some basis for why he might be that way as a person. And he might not realize that, so he is in a form of denial, maybe. What I find interesting about where we are with this episode is we left season two with, oh, David's kind of going to be the villain now. And even though that season they do play with the word villain, still, you know, the villain, the bad guy, whatever. And watching what they've done so far this season, I'm finding it very interesting because they're it's like they're trying to walk a very fine line, and so far, I think they've done a pretty good job of it. Because on one hand, you still sort of like David. I think when you said you feel sorry for him, I think it's more because, I mean, I'm just guessing, I apologize if I'm putting words into your mouth, because he still generally doesn't, it seems like he generally doesn't understand that what he did was something, you know, as heinous as it actually was, that can't just be fixed by, you know, going back in time. Plus, as every movie and TV show and book has taught us, generally speaking, when you try to go back in time to fix something, it doesn't work out. Just doesn't, I don't care if you're Marty McFly or Barry Allen, it just doesn't work out.
Right. Well, I think that the whole thing the whole thing I found compelling is it asks a very deep question, and that is, you know, when you do something wrong, is there any path back for some things? And I think the Me Too movement and a lot of, you know, some of the things that have come out of that is that when someone has done something, what's the line where someone can't be forgiven? Right. And, you know, to David, I don't know that if she forgave him, if he fully accepted responsibility, if he would be capable of doing that. But it's clear that at least at this point, he can't be forgiven and he can't understand that. And I think it's his childlike simplicity that he's broken something and doesn't know how to make it better.
Yes.
And that, I think that's what, you know, it brings me sympathy for him. While at the same time, listening to Sid, you completely understand and are on her side about why she feels the way she does. The sort of the corollary of all this is, though, you know, I'm troubled by her counsel with Farouk, and Farouk is urging her to use her intimacy to get close to him so they can destroy David.
Right.
And, you know, where does that lead? Right. Does that lead to a worse ending? And is that the ultimate revenge on, you know, Professor X,
right,
for Farouk to finally get his son? And because I think you and I agree, Farouk doesn't care about saving the world. And that they've created the narrative that by just removing David, they'll save the world. And that's a fool's errand.
Yes. It's interesting. I mentioned to you briefly before we podcast, I think earlier today, I've actually been watching some of the previous season. A friend of mine got her to start watching Legion. So I watched, you know, a few episodes from season one, then she watched the rest on her own, and now I've done the same with season two, and I've watched, I would say, the first three episodes. I think we're into the fourth one maybe by now. And as we said in our previous podcast, I was more negative than you about last season. We don't need to reiterate everything I said a couple weeks ago. However, it's very interesting to rewatch that season, at least the first the episodes I have, knowing, number one, where that season eventually leads, and number two, what we've seen so far this season. I don't want to say I hate to say it, because that's not true. It's kind of working better for me than I remembered it. Again, I might hit a spot in the season where I'm like, oh yeah, now I remember why I don't like the season as much. But right now, if you go back and you watch the first couple times in season two, when David goes to meet with future Sid, and the lines she has, and you realize what she's talking about at that point, because she is talking about when she's making references to the way he is now, and it's before certain things. She's talking about the rape. She's talking about the fact of him going, you know, going to the dark side, et cetera, et cetera. It makes those scenes much more interesting to watch. I said interesting again. I'm sorry about that. It adds a weight to those scenes that before you were just, oh, this is all weird cryptic crap. And now you realize this was all planned out really well in advance. And we're going to talk a bit about that more when we talk about the second episode. How much more planning went into this show than perhaps even I would have given it credit for. Getting back to the David situation, I just find it interesting. I'm more and more convinced that where they went with David was the place you had to go, and they really wove it throughout the storyline, throughout the show. And it is interesting because he, even in early season two, he's a troubling character to follow and root for, because mm-hmm. he's kind of trying to have it both ways, and there are still a lot of issues with his character. Anyway, I don't want to get too mired on that. I feel like I'm getting into rambling mode. Let's get back to the more stuff about the episode. So beyond that, okay, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I was going to just sort of end that discussion. I think the thing that, if you take it as the journey, the thing about David that is compelling is that he has come into the realization of a lot of his powers, and he hasn't used them to just destroy, to just totally become a destroyer.
True.
And he could. We've seen that he is fully aware he can make people disappear in a mist of blood and rip them apart. So he's not manifested into the destroyer. So he does have the ability, I think, in the sincere desire to want to recapture something that existed and is hanging on to that. The question is, now that he can't hang on to it, what's his anchor to keep him from continuing on that path to becoming the destroyer?
See, but the flip side of this is, I will grant you that he has not become a world conqueror or something like that and gone power crazy and done all the things that we thought he might, could conceivably do, one who's nearly omnipotent the way he is. However, I can't disregard the fact that he kind of has still, regardless of that, still kind of set up a rather troubling situation for himself here. I mean, basically, it appears to me that he's got something, whether you want to call it a cult. You know, I know they call it a commune a bunch of times. We note in this commune that it seems to be mostly fairly young women, you know, mm-hmm. Harkening back to like the late 60s, early 70s, kind of a hippie kind of thing. They're playing upon, it seems like David's playing upon his own junkie past. And how he would, you know, there was that inhalant drug that he was always using with Lenny. And then we also saw Melanie use to a certain extent in season two. Now you have an entire house packed with these people who are all doing that. I'm not even going to talk. Once again, we brought it up briefly last time. I don't even want to talk about that giant pig thing. I'm still, regardless of whatever metaphor they may be trying to go for there, it's one of those, do I need to see that? I get it. I mean, it does make it more interesting than if everyone was just, you know, inhaling drugs or the weird pipes with the fluid going through, which had been blue and then went to red, which is finally the blue became a different color. But the point being, he's still kind of set himself up for this. He's like the classic cult leader right now.
I agree with that.
And the things he's saying are kind of emblematic of that. He keeps talking, you know, whenever someone has to keep insisting they're a good person, that's not a good sign.
Oh, I totally agree with that. And I'm not trying to whitewash him, but I would say my counterpoint to that, which I think is what the genius of what has happened so far, is that all these characters are gray, is that I did like where David said when he appears to Sid, like, I just want to be left alone. Like, he wasn't going and looking. And if you even think of Switch's journey to join David, David didn't go out in the world and bring her. Like, she answered an ad and found him.
Right.
And people that come to join David, based if the process is what was depicted in the first episode, you have to seek him out. He doesn't go out and proselytize and bring you to him.
Right. He only goes out and kidnaps people he needs to work for him.
Exactly. but that's after they've attacked his house and he had to move it.
So. Right. Well, again, it's classic cult stuff. You know, my use of the word, my nicknaming them the Davidians is not an accident, you know.
Right.
Because you think about the Branch Davidians and what happened there, you know. The only thing is, instead of having an arsenal of, you know, thousands of rounds of ammunition and hundreds of guns, you've got David, who's probably more powerful than that. Mm-hmm. So he is a one man arsenal. So it's going to kind of play out the same kind of way if you think about it.
That way. Yeah.
The thing I want to, just shifting away from David for the moment, I got to say, what, and having watched the episode, actually gotten a chance to watch this episode twice, Bill Irwin, Carrie Loudermilk, absolutely, totally, and completely steals this episode.
Absolutely. This was his moment to shine.
Yeah. I mean, Bill Irwin, those who, and probably the older folk probably know him and his enormous talents, because he was a very much a vaudevillian performer. He was a clown, so to speak, but not in the circus sense. We've seen him whip out some graceful moves on the show before. And I only know this more recently because, again, as I mentioned, I've been rewatching some of the earlier episodes, and we've seen him kind of bebopping around a lab and stuff to some. But he's very much like a ballerina of comedy. But this one was, I think, his biggest showcase. That scene when he eventually escapes from that room, when he's pretty much walking behind the woman with the tray of food, and it plays, I mean, you can see things that are, there's a certain lovely cartoon-like quality to it, you know, like something out of a classic Looney Tunes cartoon. There's something very Marx Brothers-ish about it. Mm-hmm.
Buster Keaton.
It's like all these, again, and a lot of great, yes, very silent movie type performers. And that's the kind of thing he would used to do. It works so well. You have that. And that alone is enough to say about it. And then he has to dance with his sister. Mm-hmm. And then once again, it's like, okay, this is, you're really giving him, I'm so happy because I'm realizing with my rewatching of early episodes and being this season, I'm pretty sure Carrie Loudermilk is my favorite character on the show.
That's a good call.
I don't know. I really like Clark, but I can't quite put him in that place. But Bill Irwin's been so, watching, again, doing the rewatch, so much fun, so fascinating. And there's so many different colors or shading to his character in different scenes. He's been, you know, and his relationship with his sister is really always been very fascinating, and there's so many ways it could have went wrong and been just out and out creepy, and they found a way to not do that. That's also, you know, tribute to the writers as well, but he's really, in this episode, he's so good. Between the scenes I just mentioned, and then his eventual scene, number one, his scene with David, and then later on, him dealing with Lenny, of all people, who has kind of resumed being really pretty antagonistic this season. She's not quite as victim-y as she was in season two, hoping that she would be released from Farouk's spell and control. She's the right hand man for David, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought the dance with Carrie. Was a nice juxtaposition against, you have the idea of Carrie Loudermilk being a male and female energy within a body that can coexist, and he's been nurturing of Carrie and letting her eat and learn these things. And then you have David and Sid, where David went into Sid and did something terrible to her by entering her mind. And it's a nice contrast that you have this wonderful relationship between Carrie and Carrie, where they're each a part that the other doesn't have, and they exist in a very healthy way, such that when they're separated, it's very difficult for them to not be together because of what they provide one another, and in a wholesome way, not in an unhealthy way. And that dance and combing his hair and seeing Carrie in the mirror. And I thought that Bill Irwin really got a nice set piece to, you know, exhibit his grace and physicality.
Yeah. And also, I've also often thought, and then especially with this episode, that much like the situation with David, you could see that it's their way of commenting on you know, what's going on in society as of the last couple of years with, like, the Me Too movement, etc. Mm-hmm. The stuff with Carrie and Carrie and how you just described it, and, you know, it is, you know, at many times it is, like, you know, the dual identities within one body and shifting back and forth, it does kind of play with the notions of gender identity, especially mm-hmm. when they do the dance that, you know, their outfits have switched. You know, it's right. You know, it's like Desmond and Molly, you know, from Oh Bloody Oh Blah Da or something.
Right.
And I'm saying that because, you know, something that's been a much bigger, I don't want to call it an issue, but something that's been more and more examined in the last several years has been gender identity, whether it be, you know, either people who are trans or how they identify themselves and so on and so forth. And to a certain extent, I think this is kind of a unique way. I don't say it's directly addressing it, but I feel like it does touch on it. I feel it is kind of, if nothing else, at least kind of a nod and a nudge towards that, you know. And the show does do that. You can even say they're doing that a little bit with the Vermillions, where it's not really spoken about. You have these women who are androids, but they have mustaches. Mm-hmm. Never explained. And by the way, so 3 episodes into season 3, I'm still waiting for something about what's her name to lose her damn arm. Just say. I mean, I think we all know how she's supposed to lose her arm, but come on. Person watching it, but she mentioned it was a plague, so maybe the plague. It's like, bah, fooey. I don't think that's what she meant though. Anyway. So yeah, I just wanted to mention Carrie Laudermilk. Definitely MVP. You know, I got that right because of the All-Star game, I guess, of the episode. The only other thing I had to say about this, there was a few little musical things I wanted to make note of. I know you always like to touch on music as well. Mm-hmm. Because it moved me to even tweet a homemade meme about it. I call this the Charlie Browniest episode of Legion I've ever seen.
Yes.
Because, number one, a song that I was not familiar with, it's actually from the original musical production that was done, I think, back in the 60s, and then has been reprised on Broadway over the years. You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. The song, which is basically, you know, I think it's good. I think it might be called Good Grief, Charlie Brown, or something like that. They use a piece of the song in the very opening, and it's really great. It's also nice because it's actual kids singing the song, so you can, you know, it's a great song.
Which I think is the view into David that we talked about earlier. Like, you know, the sort of the childlike simplicity of navigating exactly. difficult things. And yeah, I thought it was a wonderful touch. And was every time I'm thinking I can't be surprised, there's something that this show does, just a little tweak or a little thing that's surprising. And I thought that sort of came out of left field, but was wholly appropriate.
And then it gets complimented later on when we have this moment with, I guess it's in, you know, the Shadow King or Farouk's own head, where he's playing piano and it's black and white. And the, I don't know how else to say this. I'm going to put air quotes. And the women in the lounge are all about, pretty sure they're not women. I don't think they're women. But he's playing what people know. He's playing on piano. He's playing O Tannenbaum. Mm-hmm. But it's basically the Vince Guaraldi, you know, Charlie Brown Christmas album version that everyone recognizes that version to be. So mm-hmm. I was like, okay, they're, and funny that someone like Farouk is playing a song which is about, you know, Christmas, which therefore is Christians and so on and so forth. Which makes no sense, but it's really kind of gorgeous in some way. So I thought that was kind of funny. And if one is paying any attention to what the little, what's this guy? Is this guy's name Squirrel? Did they establish that guy's name is Squirrel?
Yes, Squirrel.
Okay, so the junkie guy who didn't go poof with the house and that Division 3 has, and I guess when Clark is making a some half-hearted attempt to interrogate him, even though he knows full well he's just going to drop him out of the plane so they can follow him. He's basically saying the lyrics to Chris Cross's Jump.
Yeah.
Which I thought was just, I was like, wait, what? So I'm listening, it's like, because I know that song. I was like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if they had to get the rights to that or not. I'm not sure. But,
which I think leads to like sort of the third, you know, set piece that was the capture of Carrie, that following the drop where you see the Mad Hatter's tea party.
Oh yeah. And,
you know, which is beautifully visualized. And the only regret I have of the episode was that the battle that was set to take place, we didn't get to see a little more of Carrie, the swords person, in action.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a letdown in that regard, that's true. But the thing I thought was funny about it is that how they just did not see this coming. How easily that they were tricked to the point where it's kind of sad. But you're right, like what you said at the opening, this was a very brisk episode. I mean, it was you know, usual time slot, hour time slot, you know. I don't think it went beyond that. If it did, it went beyond it by like a minute or two. But it just kind of zipped by. And maybe that's one of the reasons I liked it, but I think Legion doesn't tend to drag anyway, for the most part. We'll see what we say about the next episode. Are we ready to move on to the next episode?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right, so we are moving right along to Chapter 22. Oh, I realize I didn't mention who the writers and directors were of either of these episodes. I didn't feel like it. I looked up who they were. I was like, they're fine people. I just say they're fine people. I sound like the president or something. Like, I know they're like, and it sounds bad because there were, I think, two women co-wrote the episode we just talked about. But I saw what they had done before, and I was like, who cares?
Well, I will say, to put a bow on it, I thought that episode was maybe my favorite so far, because of Bill Irwin and seeing Sid and David's conversation. I don't know if it will stay there, but I thought it was an excellent episode.
Yes, I would say I probably agree. I probably enjoyed it more than the first one. No, not probably. I know I enjoyed it more than the first one. And the one that we're about to talk about, I'll make it clear what I'm at. You know what? I'm going to talk about it in 30 seconds. I'll just make it clear here. So, okay. Step, mark, stop. No more conversation about Chapter 21. We're now moving on to Chapter 22. This is where where I'll make the thing for the segment breakdown. All right. So, super quick synopsis is, basically, we get the story of how David's actual parents met and how the Shadow King eventually attached himself to David. See how quick that was? Cool. Now I get to say a little bit more. Now, a couple times over the history of this series, we have spent an entire episode pretty much on a specific character's backstory. And it's usually something that we've already been told about previously. It's always an odd choice that they do this on the show. And I'm of two minds on it. And I just realized something we totally forgot to talk about in the previous episode. Shame on us. We'll talk about it in a second. This always yields like a really well-crafted episode. Sometimes it becomes hard to say whether it was an ultimately necessary episode, and whether it gave that much more dimension to whatever characters they focused on, whatever. It's open to debate, depending on what episode you're talking about and how well they worked. The one that comes to mind first and foremost is that one that was focused on Sid last season. You know, when we really delved into her childhood and her backstory or whatever. But most of the important highlights of that we already knew. We had already been told. To a certain extent, that's what happens here. we kind of sort of already know who Dave's father is, at least those of us who have been paying attention. And we know that, you know, as kind of revenge upon his own father, the Shadow King eventually takes hold or goes inside, or however you want to phrase it, I haven't figured out the right way to put it yet, into David as a baby. The difference here is, you know, yeah, we're seeing David as a baby. It's not, the focus isn't really on David, it's on his parents, and these are characters we've never met before. You know, it's Gabrielle and, I don't know, some guy named Charles. It looks a little professorial. It's kind of professorial to me, you know.
Maybe if he has a hell of a basement lab.
Yeah, you know, maybe if he had, you know, some wheels, you know, cut his hair a little shorter. Anyway, regardless of what I just said, and we'll get to my eventual opinion of both of our opinions as we talk about this episode. But I've been deliberately light on details, even with all that blah, to afford you as much room as you want to go here. So, you know, pick and choose where you want to go with this episode. And I bet I know where you're going to go first, but I want to see if I'm right or wrong.
Well, I'm going to give you a hot take. I was distracted the entire episode because the actor they chose to play Charles was prominent on another show you and I watch,
yes,
that very few other people watch, named Counterpart.
Such a good show.
And because he was such a big part of that show, I think I was so connected to him as that character that it bothered me that he played Charles in this. And I, not that I hated his performance, but I just saw him as, is it Peter Quill?
Mm-hmm.
It's not Quill. Peter Quill's Guardians of the Galaxy. see, that's what happens. This is what happens around 11:30.
It didn't begin with a P.
His name was on Counterpart. Okay. But that actor is so synonymous with that part and Counterpart that it took me out of him being Charles.
Mm-hmm.
Now the actor who played his mother was fantastic in sort of showing her struggle with loneliness and being separated from Charles. And, you know, I think the first thing I would pose about the actual story, from that aside, is, it, you know, Charles sort of pushes her back to the world. She's in the catatonic sort of state due to the trauma of being in the camps, and he's recovering from the war. And it sort of seems to suggest he enters her mind to push her towards convalescence. And that's sort of where we start. Now, I'm sure we'll talk about later about whether any of this is real, to the extent what is real, and did Charles create something in her mind. But, you know, the idea that Charles's own father, to sort of foster a relationship with a woman he was interested in, went into her mind and sort of gave her mind a push in a direction that resulted in a relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
Not in a way that made her forget, but in a way that had he not done that, she might have sat in that, you know, recovery ward and never left.
Interesting. I hadn't really thought about it that way, as far as the whether the casting would have distracted me. Quail was the name, by the way. It's Peter Quail. So you were so close. Yeah. Quail can be called. Can't get much closer than that.
I was close.
It didn't bother me as much, but I understand that because he was so prominent, and it's not like what we saw was. There were certainly different characters, but we're not talking night and day where you could just totally freak. You know, it wasn't like he was lost in makeup and you know, costumes here or something. And I didn't look it up, so I might be wrong about this. I guess I could have looked up while you were talking, but I wasn't too busy listening to you. If I'm not mistaken, I think the actress who was playing his mother, I'm pretty sure that's an actress who has been on the last first few seasons of Mr. Robot. Pretty sure it was her. I could be wrong about that. Because if it's her, she's a mistress of accents. Because I was really impressed with it. I'm actually going to talk slower for a moment, just see if I can find out if it's her or not, and then I'll actually say her name, which is probably something hard for me to pronounce like that. Darlene.
She looked very familiar to me, but I didn't have a place for where I'd seen her, obviously, the way I did for him, because he's, a distinctive looking guy and recognize it. Now, for most people, they probably won't care because nobody watched Counterpart
Right,
the
right.
movie.
You know,
So.
shame on you people for not watching Counterpart. You know, Counterpart. One, I mean, season one of Counterpart is one of the best first seasons of any show in a long time. Season two, it gets better as it goes along, but season one, ooh, season one's really good. Oh, by the way, I am right on this one. She played Joanna Welick,
Oh,
Tyrell's
wow.
wife.
Okay.
So I knew it because she has a very distinct, well, face. And oh, that's right, she was in a couple episodes of Legend of Tomorrow. Oh, good for her. Ooh, I just accidentally spoiled myself something about the show. Can't, won't say it on the podcast. Don't want to be accused of spoiling things. But I guess you can guess just from me saying that. Okay. So what could you possibly have seen on IMDb page that would be a spoiler? Oh, she's going to be in more than one episode, maybe? Anyway. One of the things I really liked was how there's a certain mirroring of the pilot and
Absolutely.
Sid and David's relationship of what they do here with Charles and Gabrielle. I mean, they go out of their way to make that clear by with the reprise of using the Rolling Stones, "She's Like a Rainbow," as a montage of moments between them. I mean, so even if even if you want to skip over all the little details and the things that they actually do, and the fact that they're meeting each other in a mental facility, as they say, or institution or asylum, use whatever phrase you want, and it's very interesting. It's also interesting that you can even come up with other little things that happened during the course of the episode, which one can say, hey, that's a little bit sort of kind of like what happened in the pilot, like. For example, when everything goes kablooey in the pilot, people are trapped because their doors are taken away and they can't leave their rooms. They're trapped, and they kind of something briefly like that happens to Gabrielle later in the episode, where all of a sudden there's no doors in her room and there's no way for her to escape the room for a moment there.
For the date with Pa.
Right, and I want to give them a lot of credit here because they really, and it's Holly and whoever else was co-writing this script. I forgot to look it up, but give them credit for really resisting the temptation to go any heavier into the X-Men lore and with Professor X. They're really treading on it ever so lightly. Someone could genuinely be watching this and not. And in fact, maybe a lot of people, if they're not familiar with the X-Men, they won't know who that is. They will not realize that.
I think there were only really two, well, I take that back, three nods to X-Men lore that I explicitly caught, and I've only watched the episode once, but obviously you see the precursor of Cerebro. And they say his name is Charles finally. You wait for it and you wait for it and you're like, I know this is Charles, but then you wait and I think his name is said once.
But I don't think they ever say his last name.
They don't say his last name, but his name is said Charles once.
Yeah, oh
So
no, they definitely say Charles. That they definitely say
and
it, but
so you get that. And then the third thing that I think was a nod to X-Men fans was the chess game between the two of them, which is reminiscent of Charles and Magneto playing chess, as they often do.
right. Okay, I can
So
see that.
I think that was sort of the third little tip. But like you say, I mean, they give tips of the cap. They don't do homages to X-Men lore.
Right. But what's interesting, though, if you do have you know, just a moderate level of X-Men knowledge, which I would say it would be the situation. I mean, this, you could probably fill this room with stuff I don't know about the X-Men, but I know some. You know, I know a lot of the Silver Age information. I know stuff I've picked up on, you know, from the movies, and I've read the occasional X-Men comic over the years. So I did bone up, so to speak, a little bit when Legion first started. After the first couple episodes, because Dan knew some stuff, and I just did research online to find out more about the Legion character and just who he was and what he was capable of doing. I think it's interesting that, for example, that Charles becomes attracted to and involved with a woman who had suffered, you know, in the camps, as I said.
Right.
And what's one of the things we know about X-Men lore, at least that's what's been established in more recent years, if not, you know, 50 years ago, is Magneto.
Mm-hmm.
And who I always looked at as having very much almost a Cain and Abel relationship with Charles. And Magneto was someone who also came from the camps and you know, suffered through that. So the fact that there would be this level of sympathy. So and it's interesting because this is supposed to be take place very early in with a very young Charles Xavier, before he's even met anyone else who has any sort of abilities at this point, it seems, from what he says in this episode, at least. Therefore, it's before he's met Magneto, I'm guessing. Right? I mean, or what's Magneto's actual name? I'm forgetting right now. Is it Eric something?
Yes, Eric.
And I'm, shame on me for not remembering Magneto. I'm just, you know, but I'm a DC guy, so, you know, I'll take these things. Unless we talk about Spider-Man later. We'll see. So it's interesting how these two meet. And how much it parallels the Sid and David stuff. Although it's also funny seeing, like, you know, who is more damaged at the time. Because do we really see any reason why Charles would be in an asylum?
No. I think the suggestion of the show is that, you know, at times he had used his power to cause people to commit suicide, and perhaps that had somewhat corrupted or tainted his mind because he'd used it for this purpose to cause the German soldiers to kill themselves. And I don't know if, like, he was a psychic commando that did that over and over, and maybe that's what it was suggesting. But finding him there amongst the people that were there, he seemed to be way more functional than the other people surrounding him, which is why, you know, as we've talked about in the past, the unreliable narrator that this show often uses, there are questions about how much of that's real and what is real. And I think, you know, there are parts of what we see, obviously, that are real. But, you know, when he says he does something, I forget the exact words, but when they get to leave, and it's like he does something and then they're free to leave and they go build their life. And that seemed like a very tidy way to just, they go off and have a life. And,
right.
And that seems suspect. I think there are steps that probably are missing, that it didn't happen that way, but that's the memory that's created, or at least maybe the thing David's traveled back and seeing.
Right. I would probably liken that more, not liken, that's not the word at all, attribute that. I'd attribute that more just to the nature of how they tell a story on the show, that they're doing things with a certain flourish, so we wouldn't go through what would be a more mundane way of going about things, because, you know, obviously if Charles has the ability to do this, and of course he does, he absolutely does, that's why my feeling is he, whatever reason he's chosen to be, that he's there, I feel he's chosen to be there, maybe due to guilt over what he did in the war, and that's why, that is the only conceivable reason they put that scene in there, because otherwise there's no reason for that scene to be in this episode at all. You know, debatable whether it worked or not. I thought it was fine, but it may be things like that which led him to, like, okay, I need to get away from society, or or just, you know, whatever. The fact that he's not even speaking when he sees the doctor, but he can clearly read his mind, and this part of his realize that he could say something and make everything be fine right now, but he won't because it's in a way it's maybe he's torturing himself by, you know, this is what he feels he deserves. Because what I recall about Charles's character, or who Professor X is, he's a good guy, right? He's essentially a good person. He might be a couple things he didn't think that great, but also the fact that everything we're seeing, that as the episode proceeds, we become to realize where we're kind of watching this along with David and Switch. So that's the other reason I think it's got to be, you know, if they've traveled back in time, this is what they're seeing. Again, with the little flourishes that the show will take. I guess one of the core things about the episode, and again, it falls into what I call the tragedy of time travel, that one, trying to do something to prevent something from happening, David, to a certain extent, helps make that thing happen.
Right.
You know? The fact that he's trying to make his way through, to communicate to his mother specifically, and the way what she becomes aware of, either because there's a level she's aware of when she's sleeping and then when she's awake, he's driving her back insane.
he's exacerbating her paranoia and fear. Yeah. And, you know, she's already scared and alone, and he's making it worse. And you know, the in particular, you know, there's the moment in that where he says mommy, that it gets real creepy.
Yeah.
You know, that whether that's the manifestation of how he did it or just the manifestation of how she took it because she's going insane, that, you know, you see she's not comprehending what he's trying to say in a way other than there's an external force. And then, you know, I thought it really did a nice job of sort of using the tropes of, like, there's something wrong with the house movies, you know, like, she's creeped out and she's alone in this house. Charles is gone. And it sort of used those tropes to show her afraid and alone and scared. And then David contributes to that by doing things that freak her out. And then you start to see the smoke and you see Farouk sneaking, you know, trying to sneak to David. And I thought one of the most arresting visuals was, you know, when the TV went black and you had sort of the poltergeist moment in it.
Yep.
And, like, you know, you start to see, like, there's going to be a face on the TV and David's yelling at her. So it really did bring in these tropes of all the movies where, like, there's something wrong with the house, sort of show her losing it. And I thought that was really great.
Yeah. I mean, that's – it's interesting because it's not – it's one of those things, like, I feel like I should have anticipated that's where the episode was going to go, because they kept having these little weird – little ever so brief interludes where the soundtrack would switch to whatever's being played in the, you know, in the Davidian's house, where I guess it's the song where Captain Watt or something like that, which is actually a cool song, by the way, but, you know, it's got that almost like disco like beat to it, and it kept penetrating this story which we're watching, which is taking place, you know, not during the disco era, from what I could see. Although, doesn't it feel like it looks like it takes place in a bygone era? But if that's David as a child, shouldn't they look a bit more modern?
Yes, and or he should be older than he
is. Or he should be far older, yeah. Because, you know, you could say Charles's look is classic, and especially if he's British, that's the way they look. But she looked like she was, when she leaves the hospital, or even when she's home, she looks like she's walked out of the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
And also the impression is with the war, because they do make a reference to her from the camps. Mm-hmm. So you start trying to do the math. Like, I guess maybe if they were insinuating like when she was maybe a very young child and she was traumatized ever since, but still, how old could she be there? But she would, let's say she was even 5. And let's say when he finds her, she's 25. Because she doesn't seem to be much older than that, at least, you know, whatever. So that's mid-60s. Yeah, yeah, it's one of the things, maybe I better not pay much attention to it.
Well, I sort of did the math in my head and started questioning that because, as you said, you add the camps, the look of the mental hospital they're in, you add the look of how the house they're in and how they're dressed, and it sort of seemed to be classic 50s, maybe early 60s at the latest.
Yes, at the latest.
And so I started doing the math, and the thing I thought was, you know, if Farouk attached to David, you know, does that slow the aging process? Or, you know, could it be that the fact that Farouk embedded in him, you know, slowed his aging and perhaps, but then, you know, it's so visually arresting a show that because you have to pay attention and watch and your eyes are taking it in, I sort of stopped doing the math and just said it is what it is, which you got to do with this show a lot.
No, I agree. It was something that occurred to me while I was watching and like, this reminds me of when I used to watch The Odd Couple and somehow, you know, they have an episode where, you know, Felix and Oscar were actually serving in World War II. And I'm like going, okay, they're serving World War II. And you've made it clear that they're, you know, they're not, it's not like they're 18 years old when they're in World War II. So let's say they're 25. So I'm watching the show. It's already 1970. This episode's like 1973. So wait, how old are they supposed to be at this point?
You know? Right.
It's like, right. Oh my God. But then again, it might work. Who knows? Because also when they show Charles fighting, again, I could be totally wrong on this. My memory might not be, because I didn't rewatch the second episode. But that felt more World War One to me than World War Two.
I took it more to be World War Two, but
I think it has to be. It just had the look of World War One. But yeah, I agree. It has to be World War Two just to fit the narrative of what they're trying to tell. But I don't know. Anyway. Hey, question. So once you mentioned that TV, so before the TV starts going loopy, she's watching something where there's someone, correct me if I'm wrong, is there not someone speaking Japanese on the television? Or Chinese, I should say?
I didn't have the subtitles on when I was watching it, and I wish I would have, and I meant to go back and watch it and do it, but I didn't have time. But there, it was not, you know, it was something foreign for sure.
Well, I guess I must have had the subtitles on because one of the things that is said, in fact, just before the TV snaps off, is bedtime is here, which isn't that the phrase that we saw at the very beginning of the first episode?
I think so. Yes.
Yeah. So, this doesn't make much sense except of the influence that David was having on things with you know the voice or whatever. Part of me was wondering. Is somehow Switch having an influence here? If somehow, maybe unintentionally? Because otherwise, I can't explain why we would be seeing that. It looked like almost like a video version of what she would be listening to on her headphones with her, you know, trying to figure out.
That makes sense. Now, I did not catch that, but if not only the bleed over of David is making its way into that world, it's also the bleed over of Switch. That makes sense.
Which is, you know, because, and as we find out towards the end of the episode, she isn't, when she's time traveled, she doesn't normally go this far back. And quite frankly, it's probably even further back than it should be, but whatever, we already beat that horse to death. And in fact, it's even having a physical effect on her, where I think she loses a tooth or teeth there or something. She looks pretty bad. So even if she's not going out of her way to, say, speak or influence the people, maybe just her presence there, and being, you know, in such so far back so she's not used to it. So I'm wondering if I know there's been some time travel tropes where characters don't usually travel, say, like outside of their own time span. I think that was the thing, and I could be wrong about this. And if I mess this up, I apologize to myself as well as everybody else that I'm forgetting something I should remember. And Dan, if Dan was here, he would correct me. Quantum Leap. Wasn't Quantum Leap one of the Quantum Leap's conceits with that Sam could only leap back as far as his own time span? So therefore, he couldn't leap back to, say, like, the 19th century or to the time of Lincoln or Washington. It can only be in whatever years he was actually alive. So if he was born in, say, like 1948, he couldn't leap back before 1948 or something like that.
I think there was something about if he went outside of his time that it could possibly have terrible consequences, so he was limited.
Yeah,
I don't remember if it was his time frame or the time frame of him plus his parents, or but there was some limitation.
I think it was on him, because I don't think we ever saw him travel beyond. I don't know if I remember seeing him travel beyond the 50s. I mean, if he did, I don't see, because otherwise, because I think of all the story possibilities they could have done in, say, the 20s or the 30s or whatever, and that wasn't done, or even the 40s. I don't recall him having any World War II things. Again, I might be misremembering, but I think, and I don't want to get too much down the Quantum Leap road, I just remember thinking that could be the situation with Switch as well, because she's fairly young, and, you know, so she is just probably not used to travel. And we've seen that corridor, the time is a hallway thing, you know, to go back that far, that's you got to go pretty far back down that hallway. You know, she's used to going back, you know, X number of hours or days or weeks. You know, we're talking decades now. That's probably something she hasn't quite done. And based on the stuff she's listening to and the little bits that we're seeing on the screen in these episodes, it seems like she's still in the learning phase. She's still just learning how to use these abilities.
Yeah, and it seems like David is none too happy when she doesn't want to try it again.
Right.
So that's, you know, that looks like there might be trouble coming down the road there.
One of the really unexpected things in this episode, which also lent itself to the creepiness beyond the haunted house nature of it, which, you know, definitely, was bringing back the angriest boy in the world. Oh, the world's angriest boy in the world.
Yeah.
And that actually being a doll, you give a baby. And they even try to explain it away how, the, you know, she mentioned something about the child having nightmares. And Charles says, a baby that young, they don't have nightmares. So, which therefore makes it okay to give him the scariest looking doll ever.
Exactly.
But I just thought that was like, oh, it's almost like you're almost foreshadowing what's going to be popped inside that baby, you know, probably by the end of this episode. Speaking of that, and or maybe not speaking of that, something did not touch on in the previous episode. I know we mentioned a little bit in the first episode a couple weeks ago, but still need one of the things I'm really, really, really enjoying about the season so far is bringing back the whole thing of David at war with himself.
Mm-hmm.
The multiple day, even if it's sometimes just on the soundtrack. And so you have to really be paying attention. And by the way, that's where, you know, even though a certain other podcaster used to be on this podcast much more regularly, poo-poos the idea of using subtitles. You know, feh. When you do that, then you get to see things like David 1 and David 2 or David 3. So you know there's multiple Davids talking to each other. Right. And that was at work in the previous episode. I don't know if it was at work here or not. I can't remember now. But thinking about the previous episode and how he wants so much to fix things, and now we see that he goes this far back, and we see the tragic nature of, oh, you tried so hard to fix something and you might have made it even worse or been somehow responsible for it, you know, depending on how you view time loops and time paradoxes and whatnot. I kind of like that, because it's kind of one of those things I really enjoy about time travel. You're always going to screw it up. So,
yeah. I'm curious, by going this far back and suggesting she never went that far, I hope, in this show is notorious for having MacGuffins, I hope that we see the demon that was down the hall that's referred to in her time travel and see what that is. And, you know, after seeing this, you almost wonder if the demon down the hall is one of the, you know, Division 3 or something that's there to stop him, that he creates a time loop that people are there to stop them from trying to go back far again. Now, I did have a question, and maybe I missed it. David couldn't go through the wall to get, they go kidnap Carrie. Carrie works on something, but I don't think we explicitly saw him create something that then would allow David to pass through the field to go.
We assume it just happened and we just moved on. They cut a corner there.
Okay. I wanted to make sure I didn't miss something because I watched closely and didn't see it. And I hopefully when we return to this timeline in full next week, we'll see what Carrie's been up to.
What has he did? Yeah, I watched the previous week back to the second time around, and then I watched this one right after it. So I kind of did watching them immediately after one another. So they basically just skipped that, which is I didn't have a problem with that because I figure whatever it is he did, we're going to find out what it is. We just want to get to the story already,
right?
And since they don't. Let's be honest, Legion doesn't necessarily lend itself to completely linear storytelling anyway.
Absolutely.
So I'm okay with that. Like I said, it's funny, rewatching a few episodes from season two, I'm thinking, oh, I kind of like this more than I remember liking it. That's interesting. Or maybe my expectations were low because I had already seen it. I don't know.
I would bet it's that season two seemed so, in a way, pointless. You and Dan both believed at times it was pointless, or that it took meanders down paths that didn't seem to make sense. And at the time, I think, you know, I couldn't have disagreed with you. But there was an overall arc that was there that I don't think we saw.
Right. Yeah. No, that's got to be it. And, basically spend 11 episodes, like, is he going to get the body or not? And then, bing, bang, boom, it's over. Okay. And, and now he's bad. So, yeah, that's season two. By and large, by the time I finished this episode, I enjoyed it. I liked it. Did I love it? No. But I'll say this. Regardless of whether I love this episode or not, I do, God help me, I do kind of want to see more with these two characters. Because, I mean, let's be honest, do we not want to see a bit more with, you know, Charles and where that went? Because that seems to stuff that happens off camera. I kind of want to see a little bit of that. You know, maybe they don't want to give us everything because, you know, hey, we already told you this in weird little chalkboard animated form like a couple years ago. We don't need to show you. But then you keep showing us stuff that you didn't need to show us anyway, so why not show it to me?
Right.
And the fact that the only moment that David has, you know, quote unquote, with his father is that brief thing where he actually starts to manifest, he actually starts to break through, and that's when, you know, Daddy Charles zaps him right back into the hallway. Because part of me kept thinking, hey, maybe you should try to talk to your dad, because he's not the one who had the serious mental issues that your mom clearly has, and that aren't you picking up on you scaring the crap out of her?
No. Right.
hey, there's no reason you can't follow him to Morocco to see, because then you'll see the whole Farouk thing, and maybe you can, whatever. That was kind of, you know, ifs and buts, you know, candy and nuts, whatever. But I liked it, but I'm looking forward to where they're going with this next episode.
I agree. I liked this episode. By the end, I was ready for it to be over. I was ready not to live in the past anymore. I think it really was well crafted, and it told a part of the story. Could it have been done shorter? Maybe. But I enjoyed it. It had some Easter eggs and I can just tell you, I'm an X-Men fan. The only disappointment from the episode as far as X-Men stuff was I thought maybe there'd be a nod to Magneto. And I think, as I said, I think the chess maybe was the nod to Magneto. I thought maybe there would be something more explicit in particular since there was a mention of the camps and war. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good backstory. It definitely shows I think the difference between David and Charles, you see, is Charles does love his wife, but he's driven by his work in a way that sometimes he ignores love, or he ignores, you know, what some may consider the important things, family. And he's driven by trying to find connection with other people like him who are special and different. But I don't think there's any doubt Charles loved his family in his way. David's driven. David has powers and isn't necessarily looking for people like himself. He's looking for love. And when he can't find it, he tries to use powers and the people around him to manipulate things and do things that hopefully will help him get Sid back, in a real twisted way. So,
I really don't think that's going to happen. I don't think those two can't be back together.
They won't be. And the question is, how tragic does it all end? And, you know, based on what we've seen, I would say pretty tragic.
Yeah.
I think it'll be really tragic. But hey, it's, I'll give this show credit that I don't think there's a character in it that we've seen other than Carrie who hasn't been soiled by something they've done. And I think why you and I both are drawn to the Carries is there's sort of a purity about who they are because they're one element of their personality and they stay true to that.
Yeah.
And,
I would agree with that. Yeah. Oh, mild spoiler. Don't care. And if I don't really think that this is a spoiler, but if you guys are worried about being spoiled on something, take your earbuds out for like 30 seconds. I don't really think this is a spoiler, but you never know. So I'm going to give you 3 seconds. 1, 2, 3. Okay. Gabrielle and Charles are those actors. They're going to appear in the last two episodes of Legion. So we will be seeing them again in those last two episodes in some form or capacity. So,
interesting.
Kind of curious where they'll go with that. If it'll only be in the past, or will they dare, and I'm going to say they probably won't, show a later version of Professor X. I doubt it. But, you know, you never know. Okay. Gosh, was there anything else that I wanted to mention? The only other thing, which really isn't much of a thing to mention, but good Lord, if you had forgotten, and how could you have, if you had forgotten how truly evil Farouk really is, this episode was a reminder, like, oh yeah, he's a very bad, well, I'll put in air quotes, man, or creature, or whatever, entity, whatever it is. He's really evil. He's bad. And oh, didn't we see for the first time in a while, brief glimpse shots of what when we first saw the Shadow King? You know, that weird, disgusting, blown, you know, yellow, pasty-looking creature-like thing?
We did.
The yellow, whatever. And that's been a while since we've seen that.
It was there was a jarring image of the Shadow King.
Yeah. I think we've just gotten so comfortable with, you know, the cool guy in shades for so long. You know, speaking Farsi, they're like, oh yeah, I forgot about how that's, I'm always thinking that might be what he really is at, you know, when it comes down to it.
Mm-hmm.
Look at that. We got it done tonight. Look at that. We are awesome. All right.
Yes, we are.
So we will be together again next week. Talk about chapter 23 of Legion. I am aware that my fellow podcasters, including Dan, I think everybody's watched Dark except me, so I am the one to blame for us not getting to do the podcast on season 2 as of yet. This is on me. You know, I used to be able to blame Dan for ones from the previous years, like Travelers and The Crown, whatever. This is all my fault. I have not watched it yet. I apologize. I will watch it when I can. We will do a podcast about it. I'm getting the feeling I'm probably not going to be doing a podcast about Stranger Things season 3. I just don't know if there's time for it. I liked it. So there you go. Brian, did you want greatest podcast ever? Hey, Brian, did you see it?
I have, and I really enjoyed it.
There you go. That's it.
If you like the 80s and malls, Stranger Things season 3.
Although they could have used them all better if they really put some effort into it. But anyway, but it wasn't bad. Trying to think of anything else that I wanted to say here. I feel like there's something else coming back soon. I know Manhunter's coming back sometime this summer. I forget when. Whatever. Might be August. Not sure.
I think it's August. I
feel like it's August. So we got time. It'll probably be back once Legion is over. So be good timing for that. I'm sure that will be done because I love season 1. Looking forward to season 2. Anything else? I've knocked off a few movies in the last week or two. So that's. I saw Toy Story 4. Very good. But probably not quite as good as the previous one. Because they're trying to tell a smaller story. Or maybe because the focus was really more on Woody and some characters that we either haven't met before or haven't met in a long time, which is fine, but it's at the expense of a lot of the characters that we have been following for the past previous 3 movies who really don't get used much at all in this film. So I still really like it a lot, but it probably didn't feel as good as the previous one. That makes any sense. I don't know if you've seen it yet or not. Have you seen mm-hmm. it?
Okay. I haven't seen many movies recently because of my son's basketball league this summer. So
gotcha. I saw Spider-Man Far From Home just the other night. Pretty good. Very good, actually. It's no Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse good, but still very good. Anything I say now will be without spoilers. Do not worry. I don't think what I just said about Toy Story 4 would be considered spoilers. It's just, just a general opinion. If you have just a remote, reasonable knowledge of Spider-Man and his villains, you go into that movie knowing something that someone who doesn't know anything about Spider-Man apparently would not know, but you'd still suspect. Suffice to say, one of the characters in this movie is Mysterio, played by Jake Gyllenhaal. You can fill in the blanks yourself. I liked it a lot, although there's one little thing that's kind of nagging at me about the movie. And again, I don't really consider this a spoiler at all. You've seen the trailers, probably. And obviously, Tony Stark / Iron Man was a big mentor character for Peter Parker. So it makes perfect sense that he would still be upset or bothered by that. Although I have pointed out to someone that technically he only got bit by the spider or whatever, and all that stuff has happened within the last year or two because of how young he is in these movies. Why have I never seen him be that upset about Uncle Ben, who never seems to be mentioned in either of these 2 movies, which is a little strange. But also, as far as the world knows, Iron Man's not the only one who died in Endgame. Oh, spoiler if you haven't seen Endgame. You should be listening to this podcast anyway. What's wrong with you? As far as the world is concerned, Captain America also died. But everywhere you go, it's only things that are monuments and posters and banners for Iron Man. And I'm like, hey, call me crazy. I think everyone would be, at the very least, just as upset, if not more so, because of Captain America being dead. Kind of strange. But I know for the story, you gotta go with it. Whatever. It's Iron Man, Spider-Man, whatever. Okay.
Well, I'll give my son's 10-second review of Spider-Man Far From Home. Awesome movie, great after credit scenes. He loved the credit scenes. And his review was, if you saw the trailer and weren't sure about whether you would like it or not, that the trailer is very misleading mm-hmm. about the direction the movie goes, that you should go see it. You will love it. So. That's directly from, that's a shout out to my 13-year-old Quentin, who loves Spider-Man and thought it was awesome.
Excellent. I will say, and I've made a point of not spoiling this. Yes, there is a mid-credits and post-credits scene. That final post-credits scene, it's a lot of fun. It's interesting. Gives you some slight clue about where the MCU is going. And everyone said that without spoiling it. But I'm going to tell you something. It's that mid-credit scene. And never mind all the machinations that are like, oh, it's actually something important to the plot and where Spider-Man's going to be going, you know, with future movies and whatever. Blah, blah, blah. But there's something that you will see in that mid-credit scene that if you're a Spider-Man fan and you're a Spider and you've enjoyed his forays into the cinema, you will be so happy. I was very, very happy. And that's so all I'm going to say.
So you agree with my son.
Your son is dead on about that.
Exactly.
So. And you know, and I want to give your son a lot of credit because he's someone at that age saying that. So once you've seen it, unless you don't plan to see it, and I'll just tell you what it is when we get off the call here. So I give him a lot of credit for liking that mid-credit scene. Good for him. He shows good taste. Anyway.
He loved it, so.
And finally, I also saw yesterday the What If There Wasn't the Beatles Never Existed movie. A feel-good movie. It's really nice. And if you're basically, if you're someone who is a fan of or appreciates the Beatles, I can't imagine not liking this movie. I would be like, what's wrong with you? If you don't like the Beatles, then yeah, don't see the movie. That would be weird. But if you like the Beatles, you should see it. And if you're like a really big fan of it, oh my God, see this damn movie. And again, no spoilers, but there will be one scene that if your tear ducts aren't going to hyperdrive, there's something very wrong with you. I'm just going to say.
That's on my list too. I'm a huge Beatles fan. A couple of people whose opinion I trust about the Beatles, including a certain podcast host who may even have a living art piece to the Beatles on them. whose opinions I trust.
I was like, wait, there's someone else?
No, it'd be you. But two or three people who, you know, appreciate the Beatles as much as I do have all said the music that not only is it good, but the way the music's handled by the guy who plays it, like he actually does a good job. Like they do a good job with the music. They don't sort of do hackneyed versions of the songs.
Yeah,
like they're actually pretty good renditions.
Yeah, it's definitely done with care.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
And you know, and it's a Danny Boyle movie. Danny Boyle does have a pretty solid track record. I don't love every movie he's done, but he's definitely one of the more eclectic filmmakers of the last 25 years. And more often than not, he'll turn in something which, at the very least, is interesting. And yes, and I use that word deliberately this time. But more often than not, is vastly entertaining. Whether it be everything from Trainspotting to Slumdog Millionaire and everything in between, and now a movie like this. And also, hats off to him for getting this idea done, but also choosing to cast the movie the way he did. Love the fact that the main character is someone who is of, you know, he's, I mean, obviously they're in Britain, so he's British, but he's Indian, as opposed to just being another, you know, white guy. So I really enjoyed that as well.
Which is an interesting nod to the Indian influence in the Beatles.
Yes,
music.
It is. It absolutely is. And the movie theater where I saw it, which was here in New York, one of these Nighthawk Cinemas places, which I guess is the kind of theater where you can have a drink or eat something during the movie, I guess. But they did this really awesome thing. And from what I've been told, this is my first experience there, they do this before all the movies they show, or most movies they show, where they will compile, like, and it could be like a half an hour or more worth of material, clips and videos or for whatever it might be, and run that all together as a piece before. So when you're watching a movie which is about, you know, what if the Beatles never existed, so naturally we got a half an hour worth of Beatle-related material. And they didn't just go for the obvious stuff that we've all seen a million times before. You know, it could be like a little clips of the opening credit sequence for a 1970s Ringo Starr TV special starring, you know, Art Carney, Vincent Price, Angie Dickinson, you know, which is like, what the hell? I want to watch this TV special. Screw this movie. You know, and then they had a clip, which I'm guessing was from a documentary, of just watching George Harrison learning to play, I don't know if it was the actual sitar or what it was, but, you know, the large Indian instrument, with the guy teaching him. And obviously it's from a documentary because the guy's talking about how, you know, his mind was blown that, you know, he's, you know, this Beatle is learning this music and he ended up hearing it on their future songs and whatever. So that just made the whole experience of seeing the movie that much more enriched, so to speak. And made me curious, right. Wow, I wonder if seeing Spider-Man here, what if we got in a half an hour of Spider-Man stuff? I don't know. Anyway, I deliberately just made this podcast take longer than I should have. And I'm debating whether as a tribute to yesterday, I will sing at the end of the podcast. It's kind of late. I'm gonna give you guys a break and not sing. So instead, let's wrap it up. If you enjoyed this podcast, chances are you'll also enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page. Look us up at the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Legion and so many others. Hey, get in the conversation about Star Trek's Picard. I just posted a picture of it. People are going crazy. You can also find us on iTunes, Serious TV Drama Podcast. Subscribe to the feed and rate and review us there if you like. If you got something nice to say, at least. No. If you don't, well, feel free to do that too. I'm just going to rip you apart for the next year. I kid. No, I don't. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast, STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. I will tweet the links to our podcast, and I've gotten better about actually tweeting other things. Like this week, each night I've been doing a tonight's TV recommendation. So follow us on Twitter, and you'll know a good show to watch every day, or whenever I feel like posting that. Anything else? Yeah, you can and Google Serious TV Drama Podcast. You'll find us 8 million other places too. You know, download us legally, illegally. Hey, we used to use music that wasn't legal either. Who cares? Just listen to us. I don't really have much else to say because it's late. So, Brian, thank you once again for joining us here, whatever, at the STVD Podcast.
I enjoyed it.
I'm trying to cut down my chattiness. I know I'm failing. I'm trying. Anyway, so good night to you and good night to everybody else out there. Again, without post-production, you get treated to crap like this. What else am I supposed to do? It's ridiculous. I know. But you guys realize I'm just playing this off my iPhone, so if it sounds like shit, that's why it's like. But check this out. Homemade fade. Except I didn't put my button on the click, but oh, god damn it. The podcast is over. Good night, everybody.
Good night.